Blog Talk Radio.
And it's that time again for the Charlotte Line. This is Dr. John from the studio in Myrtle Beach, the sun and fun capital of the coronavirus world, I guess you could say. And it's been a great day here, and glad to be here at the Charlotte Line. I'll tell you that. That's so wonderful. Oh, my goodness. From 641, it must be Brady Van Sickle. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great, John. It's been pretty decent weather around here in Iowa. I've been able to mix in some walking to kind of break up the monotony of quarantine. So doing the best I can with the hand we've been dealt.
Really? I've been doing the same thing, too. Well, that's great. Well, we're glad to have you here. We're going to get everybody fired damn up, as we say here in South Carolina. And, of course, from Studio G, taking care of everything as usual, well, sometimes, Zach Beecher. How are you doing tonight, Zach?
I am something else. I literally just 5 minutes ago finished watching our race, our retro rewind, the Food City 500 from 2007. And I watched it on double speed, which I got the whole race in and got some chuckles out of how everyone was talking and sounding. So it's been a interesting past hour and a half, but it is fun down here in Greenville.
Well, it'll be more fun once things liven up a little bit. Before we get started, I've got a story about
Uh-oh.
Food City. No, it's a pretty neat story. Are you guys aware
okay.
that I used to work for Food City?
I knew that.
To
yep.
be completely honest,
great.
I don't even know what Food City is.
It's a grocery chain.
It's a great company that was put together by Mr. Jack Smith from Abingdon, Virginia. And I worked with the real estate folks for quite a while putting together two deals. One was a store in Johnson City, and the other one was a store in Hazard, Kentucky, the legendary Hazard, Kentucky. Well, I want to tell you how Jack Smith made all of his money, and he was able to afford to promote the Food City 500. He invited me and the fellow that I worked with. There was a small real estate development company out of Winston-Salem, and he invited us up to the opening of one of his stores somewhere, I mean, just Nowheresville, Virginia. Nowheresville. The name of the company was actually KVAT Foods, Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee Food Systems is what it was called. Okay, and it was like, oh, wow. Have you ever been to a Food City store, by the way? They're massive.
No.
Just massive. And, I mean, he did a great job. His son runs the company. And so Mr. Smith, you go in there, and, I mean, it was a lot like you did exactly what Jack Smith told you to do or you needed to leave. That was one of the toughest guys I've ever seen to deal with in my life, but he was very successful. And it's like, so you go in there, and just everybody's milling around, working as hard as they can, lines out the door for this brand new store in, and I mean nowhere, Nowheresville, Virginia. And I said, well, so I'm standing there next to Mr. Smith, and he said, well, John, what do you think? I didn't know what to say.
Uh-oh.
I mean, it looked like a grocery store to me. I said, well, Mr. Smith, it looks great. You got so much stuff in here, and not a lot of frills, and it's just all business about groceries. He said, we don't sell neon, John. We sell food. That's why we're called Food City, and that's why we're successful.
Hmm.
And, that is a story or a short thing told to me by one of the great entrepreneurs of America, Jack Smith, who created Food City. And he was right. If you do one thing, you do it better than everybody else. And that's all that matters. You don't care about anything else. Just whatever you do, do it better than everyone else. And that's what he did at Food City. And that's why Food City became the giant that it is. And that's why Food City has enough money to do anything they want, like run the Food City 500 up there at Bristol Motor Speedway. So, he was a great American entrepreneur, and he gave me some good advice a long, long time ago, we don't sell neon, John. We sell food. That's why we're called Food City. And there you go. So it was great. And if anybody's listening that will take that to heart, that is one of the recipes for success in this world. Don't sell neon, sell food if you're called Food City. Go Jack Smith. And I know you're hearing me say this, and I tell this story all the time. I was touched by the hand of a great entrepreneur, and he gave me some good advice, and I've always tried to heed it. So there you go. That is the greatness of the man that founded this giant food empire, Food City. And it's, you go to their store, and I went into one. I hadn't been into one in about 10 years. It was up in, It was in Johnson City on Roan Street. And it's like, dear God, this place is so huge. I mean, it looked like the Walmart of food. I mean, just food everywhere. But it was a great thing. And I hope you know, it may not sound like much of a story, but that's a story that you need to listen to. And that is one of the recipes for success. There you go, guys. There's my Food City story. And I'm very proud of him. It's the one thing he liked was wrestling. He said, told me one time, he said, John, I can do this because this is what I love. I said, but you don't sell neon in your stores, do you? And he laughed. He said, no, we don't. But I just love wrestling. And so anyway, I mean, not wrestling. Well, he loved wrestling too. But he really did like racing. All right. Yes. What was the comment, Zach?
I was just going to tell Brady, Food City is a lot like Hy-Vee up there, up in the Midwest.
Gotcha. I didn't know if it was something like a Costco or just a general run-of-the-mill grocery store chain, because that was not something I'm familiar with up here in the Midwest.
Boy, it is not run-of-the-mill. It's amazing.
It's a lot like Hy-Vee up there in Iowa and Illinois. So that's the best way I explain it to a few people now.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but it's cool, and I have not met, I think, all the folks that I worked with. They've gone on to a greater reward, and I'm still enjoying this reward. So they don't get to do the Charlotte line like I do with you guys. So
could be kind
there
of odd.
You go. Well, I'll call up and see if Lou Scuder is still around, and maybe he'll come on with us one day. He used to be head of real estate, Lou Scuder. He was something else. They were all something else up there in Abingdon, Virginia.
Does sound like it. Well, one thing that last week, we went down a little rabbit hole. That got me thinking.
Wow.
We somehow started talking about TV and how NASCAR's played into it, not just the actual races themselves, but how TV and movies – have had NASCAR affiliates with them, whether drivers are making a guest appearance or a guest starring in movies, or they're basing a whole episode or two around NASCAR like they did in Dukes of Hazzard or Stroker Ace that Brady watched, and we'll get to a lot of this. But it got me thinking, what are some of the best NASCAR commercials, TV episodes, TV movies that NASCAR drivers were in? And there's so many out there. And there's been some reality TV shows as well. The most recent one that's happening, I believe still right now, is called Racing Wives on CMT. It has a lot of driver wives from the Bushes to the Dillons. It's an interesting one. But that got me thinking, and we started talking about that, what were some of the best, some of our favorites, I guess, TV shows that had a NASCAR driver appear in it, movies and commercials. This was something that I put out to you guys, because I did my own research as well, and Brady did quite a bit of research, I know. John, I don't know how much research you did, but it shall be interesting to hear. The first one that came to mind was commercials, because, well, a lot of times NASCAR drivers make a lot of money off of doing brand deals, a.k.a. sponsorship, like how Kurt Busch is a big sponsor, it has a big sponsorship with Monster Energy, and how Kyle Busch has a lot of sponsorship money coming from M&M's and Nestle on that end. So it got me thinking, what were some of our favorite commercials of all time that had NASCAR drivers in them?
Arguably for me, I always have to point to the early 2000s because I really thought that that's where some of the marketing was at its best, especially in some of the earlier days of Sprint. They really had some really cool commercials with Nextel and the drivers, especially with like the push-to-talk that was a big feature back in 07. You know, you'd have Jimmy Johnson coming off the track and Elliott Sather be like, "Hey, Jimmy, I saw you were messing up turn one. Maybe you should cock it out a little bit more." And then Jimmy's like, "One second," as he just pulls up his Nextel phone and just walkie-talkies a guy to come over and bring over the NASCAR championship just to basically, you know, dick flop on the table. Like, "I'm so sorry, Elliott. What were you saying about my driving again?"
Go ahead, Brady.
I was just going to say, those early Nextel commercials, they just had so much, you know, wit to them, just so much clever writing. Like, there was one from 05 where this guy's walking around. He's talking to his buddy on his Nextel phone. He's like, "Dude, I'm staring at it. The cup, the Nextel cup." And he goes, "You got to touch it, buddy." He goes, "I can't touch the cup. It's in glass." And so he goes, "Well, why don't you smell it?" So this dude starts smelling the glass case, and Harvick gets on his phone. He goes, "I'm going to need security over here, man."
those were some of my favorite ones because it wasn't like – some commercials have, like, the serious notes. Some of them have, like, the you know, this is what we have. And then there's the comedic ones, which I always love those Nextel ones just for that reason. They had that – hint of comedy, and the drivers were in on it too. It wasn't just like fans just standing there talking on the phone talking about a driver. They actually had driver interaction. Like you said, they had Jimmy Johnson, Elliott Sadler. That trophy one is one that I always think of because when Brady has seen this, when you see NASCAR fans at the track, some of them for the first time had these special passes called hot passes to where you can go in the garage and stuff. You can definitely tell it is their first time, and they're having fun, but it's something to always awe and stare at. But those commercials, those Sprint ones, always, and I do mean this, always have a funny kick to them. One that I always loved were the Pepsi ones in the 90s because, one of the big boys, Jeff Gordon, was always sponsored by them, and there were some great commercials. One that I always think about is the one where Jeff is driving around, and he's not looking out of the windshield. He's looking on the floorboard. He's reaching around, and it cuts to his crew chief, Ray Evenham. He goes like, "Oh, what's he doing?" He's like, he dropped his Pepsi. It cuts back to the car. He's got the Pepsi in hand. He takes a sip. He gets the checkered flag. At the end of the commercial, Ray's going like, "We need to install a cup holder for that boy."
I don't think I've seen those ones, but in that same vein, you know, Budweiser also had some really good ad campaigns when Dale Jr. first came on the scene. The hype was real with, you know, the countdown to E-Day. He was young. He was hip. He was the perfect ambassador for the Budweiser beer company as they were looking to, you know, hit that key demographic, the 21 to 35-year-olds, and he was just perfect for that demographic. And I can just think of some brilliant advertisements from right around 2001, 2002, like, for example, when he had the designated driver campaign with fun fact, if you've ever seen that classic Budweiser designated driver where Junior's driving this guy home from the bar and this guy's taking him on this whole big loop around just to show off to all his friends, the guy that's in the passenger seat of that car is actually Steve Helms from the Hangover series.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, it was a young Steve Helms before he made it big, and I just think that's hilarious. But in addition to the designated driver one, obviously the most iconic Dale Jr. Budweiser commercial was they kind of ripped it from an interview where they asked Jr. in his rookie season, what's the one thing he wished he could add to a NASCAR? He goes, "Music. I wish I could have music." And so in 2001, Budweiser made this commercial where Dale Jr. had a stereo in his car and the CD started to skip. So he was trying, you know, he blew on it, trying to get it to work. He was going all over the track while he's trying to get the car to get the CD to work. It doesn't work, so he just shifts it into gear and smacks into the back end of Ken Schrader's car, and all of a sudden it starts working perfectly. And he just gives the most Earnhardt signature shit-eating grin to close that out. I'm like, God, now that is advertising right there.
That's a good one.
Now, I got to tell you something funny about Ken. It's about the Cale Yarborough commercials that were so popular down here in the South for Hardee's, for Hardee's Food Systems, and when they first did breakfast. And it was real funny. It's like, you know, so they got – he's playing this character named Runner, who actually is delivering Hardee's sausage and egg biscuits and Hardee's gravy biscuits to little old ladies in this town. And my mother said, well, who's that? He's a cute man. And I looked at my dad, and he said, who is that? I said, y'all ever heard of Cale Yarborough? And he said, is that what he looks like? Hell, nobody knew what he looked like until the Internet. I mean, I'm serious. You know, because people listened to the radio to listen to races. I'm serious. Nobody knew what Cale Yarborough looked like until the Internet came along. I'm dead serious. You guys didn't know the joy of, you know, everybody knew who he was. They knew he was a great, you know, great racer, but golly, nobody knew what any of these cats looked like. So, yeah, just think about it. Sunday afternoon. Do what?
I said, you got to love it, because Cale Yarborough's Hardy deal would have came out right when NASCAR started getting more TV deals, getting more exposure, and you hit it right on there, John, because back in the day, in the 60s and 70s, you weren't getting much TV coverage, so you could hardly tell what these guys looked like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Charlotte Observer wasn't running pictures of NASCAR winners. That was our local newspaper up in the mountains of North Carolina was the Charlotte Observer. And they had, you know, Charlotte Motor Speedways down here in Concord. And nobody knew what these cats looked like, but you'd go over and visit your uncle, Jay Arthur, and his wife, Aunt Edith. And he's sitting there listening to the radio because it's not on television. And it's like, who are these people? You know, it was just funny. So, yeah, the Internet has done a lot to let us know who these folks are. There you go. That is a real – that is – you know, you weren't alive – you know, if you weren't alive in 1992 when we really didn't have the Internet, boy, it was an altogether different world. So, and that's not that far back.
No, not at all.
That is for sure. Sure. And one thing, too, about that was, you know, I did some research on it. That was really one of the first times a NASCAR driver had a full-fledged commercial deal with the company, because it's been that evolution ever since then. And, you know, he was really the – I don't want to say the pioneer, but he was the way – the gateway to drivers having commercials and stuff and having these abilities to have bigger sponsorship deals, because they could promote even more, not just on the cars, but even going to the facilities, going to a Hardee's and you know, serving up breakfast and hanging out with people in the morning and going to, you know, Bass Pro and doing autograph signings and stuff. That was kind of a gateway to that. And it's so cool to see that was one of the first commercial deals to come. And when I mean commercial deals, just like John said, it was on TV. And one of my favorites, for some reason, one of my favorites is another one by for M&M's. They had stolen the M&M's car. I don't know if Brady remembers this one or not.
Oh, I remember this one.
Yep. So the red and yellow M&M's stole the car. They couldn't see over the steering wheel. The yellow one was doing the gas and the brake and just wrecking cars left and right. And it's just so funny. And it's just so much fun for it that it's a worth watching one for sure.
There's a commercial that was kind of that same concept that came out just 2 years prior in 06. And I'll always remember this commercial because growing up as a Ken Schrader fan, I didn't see him in a whole lot of, you know, advertisement promotions in the early 2000s because that was kind of towards the end of his career. But in 2006, he joined up with the Wood Brothers and they landed the Little Debbie sponsorship. And they kicked off Daytona with this brilliant advertisement of this guy walking into a convenience store, and he walks past what he thought was a cardboard cutout of Ken Schrader, and he just goes, wait, Ken, is that you? Maybe. Well, who's driving the car? And then it just pans to the cardboard cutout stuck in the driver's seat of the 21 car, going all over the track, going the wrong direction. Oh, my God. I watched that commercial so much because, like, this is it. I finally get to see my favorite driver in a commercial, and it's hilarious.
I remember that one. That is a good one. because of, and that's another thing too, like I mentioned earlier, I do love the commercials that brought the comedy with it, because it just showed that, you know, drivers have a sense of humor. A lot of times people thought that drivers were, you know, or still are, just purely, you know, straightforward businessmen. And if you were to think of like Dale Earnhardt, the Intimidator, he didn't get that nickname for no reason. He was intimidating on the track, but off the track, him and Richard Petty both had the same, you know, the same thought of a fan is not just a fan. They're people that support me and love me. And I love that. But that was something too, is these commercials and the TV spots also show that they aren't just, you know, they're not jerks or mean or anything. They're some of the nicest people and have a sense of humor. You can have a laugh with and also have a beer with. I think one commercial, and I think we might have talked about this last week, was the commercial where the drivers, I think it was for the Toyota team. It was either Toyota or for Coca-Cola drivers, where all of a sudden they can't control their cars because they're remote control. Do you remember that one, Brady?
Toyota. That was a Toyota commercial from 2008 when they got the Gibbs deal for the first year.
That's what I thought. That one was another good one. And the drivers were in those cars, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, kind of piggybacking off your idea about how comedy was used effectively back in the early 2000s, I think the two companies that utilized their drivers and utilized the humor effectively were Coca-Cola and Gillette. Because especially with Gillette, in those early 2000s days when they had the Gillette Young Guns and they were really promoting the up-and-coming drivers of the sport, kind of the change of the guard, as it were, and they had usually about four or five drivers per spot, and they were usually pranking each other, you know, shaving each other's heads and whatnot, and just lighthearted, fun commercials, effective advertising. And then Coca-Cola kind of did the same thing when they got their Coca-Cola family of drivers. And especially about 2007-08, they had an advertising campaign where they really promoted like that the Coca-Cola drivers would do anything for their fans, to do anything to get on camera drinking a Coke. And it would just show them in just these ridiculous scenarios, like on cooking shows during the Olympics, just, you know, kind of shuffling into the bottom corner of the screen just to chug a Coke. And I don't know why. It was shameless. It was stupid, but I laughed every time. And I'm like, that's effective advertising right there.
All right. I'm ready to tell you the biggest crash and burn in political history. Are you ready for this?
No.
This is the biggest crash and burn in the history of all politics. There was a wrestler. I've been talking to Papa Stroh today. That's what I keep saying. There was a race car driver named Richard Petty that everybody in North Carolina would have laid down and died for. Okay, I'm telling you, he was the most popular human being on the planet. Do you know that Richard Petty ran for Secretary of State for North Carolina?
What? I knew he dabbled in some government offices, but I didn't know he tried for Secretary of State.
Yes, he was running for Secretary of State, and he was crushing it in the polls. Everybody wanted Richard Petty to be the Secretary of State of North Carolina. Secretary of State doesn't do anything. They've got a whole staff. He would have just been the greatest piece of promotion for the Tar Heel State in the history of the world. So what happens is Richard Petty is, you know, what does he do? He's a race car driver. Now, this was after his, you know, he was semi-retired at that point. He was going to retire and go work for the state of North Carolina. So what happens? He's behind some dude on Interstate 40 going from, like, Raleigh to Greensboro. And so – and the guy's – and traffic's clogged up. The guy's driving slow. You're not supposed to drive slow in the left-hand lane. You're not. So what happened is Richard Petty, being a professional driver and being a man who probably has more control over a car than anybody else, he gets up on the guy's tail and he taps him. You know, it's like, get out of the way, get out of the way. He does it several times. Well, you know, it was a shame that he did it in front of a highway patrolman who did not know who Richard Petty was. And made the front page of every newspaper in North Carolina. And he was out of the race the next week. I mean, you know, it was over. It was history. And everybody was upset. He knows better than that. Well, no, if you think about it, Richard Petty knows how to drive a car. He knew at that time probably better than any human being on the planet how to control a car. Would you agree? He knew what he was doing.
For sure.
And just because he wasn't thinking, he just tapped him on the bumper. Rear bumper about probably 7 or 8 times. And the cop, we don't know who the cop was. It was just so stupid. Richard Petty had been the greatest thing. And it was horrible, horrible, horrible. And my friend Elaine Marshall, Secretary of State, and she's been Secretary of State for 30, 40 years. But anyway, that's the great Richard Petty in politics story.
I think one funny thing, because you did say that, reminds me of what's that comedian's name? Jeff Foxworthy had a great line from one of his stand-ups. Says, "I believe if you're going slow and fast lane, I should have the right to get up under you, get you loose, and put you in the wall so I can go faster."
I'm sorry, say that again.
Essentially, he kind of said it should be legal for what Richard Petty did. Should be legal. You should be able to get up under someone if they're going slow in the fast lane, get them loose, get them out of the way, and keep going.
Yeah, he's probably right about that. He was probably talking about, he must have just had dinner. He and his wife must have just had dinner with the Petties.
That was
working out.
So now, besides commercials, there's also, the TV spots and movies. There are some good ones that have Junior has good NASCAR drivers in them. One, there's always the stereotypical one of Ricky Bobby of Talladega Nights has a lot of NASCAR drivers in it, from Junior to other ones. Excuse me. Another big one is Herbie the Love Bug in the reboot in the early 2000s with Lindsay Lohan had quite a few drivers, including our own Jimmy Johnson, who at one point told, I believe it was Jeff Gordon, "Hey, that car just winked at me." He goes, "Nah, man, nah." He goes, "No, that car winked at me." And Jeff gave him the look of like, "Oh, you're going crazy. We got to get you checked out.
Definitely remember that one. That was right around 05, right before another movie was going to come out, because that was the same year as Talladega Nights. So we got two major motion pictures with NASCAR references that year. So that was big for the sport. The year following that, in 06, NASCAR went animated, where we got major drivers and major key components of our sport as voice actors in the Cars movie that came out. And if you've ever taken the time to look into the special features on the Cars DVD, the amount of effort and research they did on that first one to not only bring the world of a car to life, but also into the racing footage. They'd have like little marbles that would scatter the track to kind of give it that realistic feel. They brought in the actual king of NASCAR, Richard Petty, to voice the pretend king. Dale Jr. had a guest cameo part. They brought in Waltrip, of all people.
Waltrip, okay.
The iconic voices of that movie. Just fantastic from a marketing standpoint to get NASCAR not only in the public perception, but into the perception of a bunch of young race car fans, at the time, myself included, because I was still in elementary when that first one came out. And just to have not only your brand associated with an animated property like that, but arguably one of the biggest animated properties with Disney Pixar, was a huge boost for the sport.
I really think that is one that got a lot of newer fans in, because kids watching that maybe fell in love with racing. I know some people have said, "Well, just a cartoon and stuff." And I go, like, "Well, there's a lot of, like you said, I have actually seen those features before that talk about Richard Petty coming in and all the research they did, not just of Richard Petty himself, but also racing and how tire wear and everything would work." And by the way, if you've never seen a Pixar movie, Cars is a great. The first Cars is a great one to watch, and then watch the special features, because it truly shows what that company does, which is research, research, research. They spend probably more time doing research for future movies than they probably do spending time at a college, getting a college degree, I believe. But we've also had some older movies, and one of the ones that I Well, one that Brady finally watched was Stroker Ace. How was that, Brady?
It was not good. I'm going to be completely honest with you. The best way I can describe it is it was in tone and the kind of humor and the commentary it was making, it felt a lot like Talladega Nights, but the execution was just god-awful. The jokes weren't funny. It just felt like a very lifeless movie. There were some very questionable parts that probably were okay in comedy back then, but watching it through my 2020 lenses, I'm like, man, you can't do that. That is not okay, you know? So that was part of it, but it just, I don't know, it felt like a cheap money grab to kind of capitalize on the remaining fumes of the Smokey and the Bandit franchise creation in the late 70s, and it did not hit the marks. And I couldn't help myself, so I was doing some more research about the movie, and I saw that that Burt Reynolds had the opportunity to star in a different movie at that time, a movie that went on to get Oscar buzz, and the role that Burt should have played ended up getting Robert De Niro one of his Oscars. But Burt Reynolds decided to do the Stroker Ace movie as a favor to a longtime friend, Hal Needham. And he said he always points to that movie as being the biggest mistake and regret of his career, because right soon after that, he kind of lost his prestige and his edge in Hollywood, and he just wasn't showing up in really good quality movies anymore. He was kind of just getting the bit comedy roles that he could get from there on out. So it was kind of a career killer for Burt Reynolds too, and it was a shame because there was so much potential. Like I said, they had a good concept, and that concept ended up working great in the movie Talladega Nights, but just the execution wasn't there. The joke writing was lazy. It just, I don't know. I wanted to watch it for a long time, but was always apprehensive because I just didn't know how well it was going to be executed. And I gotta say, it was bad. It was really bad.
All right. Well, here's another question for you. Which one had a better? Which one was a better movie, Stroker Ace or Sharknado 3?
See, I've never seen it in the Sharknado, so I cannot weigh in. But
oh, it's terrible. They're terrible.
Critically, it has the same Rotten Tomatoes score as Cats, the new Cats movie. And I got to say, I enjoyed Cats more.
You watch Cats? Ew.
Okay, so actually...
Cats? Have you ever seen it on the stage? Jesus, it's a great musical. It's great.
I've never seen it on the stage. I imagine it probably is better as a stage performance. But in the movies, it just did not translate well to film.
I heard it never ended. It's still going on. I heard it just never ended in the theater.
So my buddy and I were like, dude, we got to go see this movie. It seems like an utter dumpster fire. We have to go see it. And so we did. It was like us two and a group of like five or six high school kids. So not like a completely deserted theater. And we just all bonded over just this experience of watching this utterly garbage movie and just laughing the entire time. It was one of the best theater going experiences, I got to say, I've ever had, because it was just kind of cool to be, you know, that united, like, man, this movie sucks, you know, but at the same time, I was thoroughly entertained. Like, I will not tell you it was a good movie, but I was thoroughly entertained and do not regret going to see it. Whereas on the other hand, I bought Stroker Ace because it was like, well, I could either rent it for $4 or buy it for $6. So I bought it for $6. I'm like, man, I wish I could get my money back. That was bad.
Oh, that's funny. That's
okay.
Funny. What?
All right.
But
name.
That is the thing. Uh-oh.
What? What?
Go ahead, John.
Okay, yeah. The most creative use of a personality in a movie goes to, the winner is 1968 Elvis Presley starring in Speedway as a race car driver.
I still haven't seen that.
was a great Elvis film. Didn't have a lot to do with racing, and it was, and Elvis got the girl in the end, and he finished third. He didn't win. He finished third. And I figure after what, 60 years, I can go ahead and tell the ending, and I won't ruin your experience. He spun out there and didn't cross the finish line first. But anyway, no, it was like, you know, here's Elvis Presley. I mean, just the biggest thing on the planet. This was, I think, one of his last big feature films, and it just kind of got oil. There was oil all over the track when by the time he was finished. Yes.
To be talking about famous racing movies and not talk about arguably our biggest artist film we're probably going to get about a NASCAR themed movie, and that's Days of Thunder. And yes, the movie is cheesy, the movie is corny, it came out in 1990, what do you expect? But honestly, it's a solid film, and I had my buddy watch it, and he's not a race fan, he'd never seen it before. He's also not a big Tom Cruise fan, and so he's a very, very, you know, particular about his movies, and one of those quote-unquote cinephiles that really takes movies seriously. And so I was really curious to see what his opinion would be about Days of Thunder. He goes, man, I'm mad. I had a good time. The soundtrack, the score was hype, pure late 80s, early 90s, just goofy garbage enjoyment. He goes, I could not have asked for anything more from that movie. It was exactly what that kind of movie needed to be. And I'm like, you know what? For a review from you, that is a high praise. So, I mean, what more can you say about it? It's fun. It's lighthearted. Tom Cruise and Robert Duvall play opposite each other beautifully as driver crew chief. And if you know anything about Rick Hendrick's story about the early days with him and Tim Richmond, it's kind of loosely based off of Hendrick's early days with Tim Richmond. But even kind of more scary, Tom Cruise's character feels way more like Jeff Gordon, and this movie came out 2 years before Jeff Gordon even was remotely on the NASCAR scene as someone people were talking about, you know. And so the fact that it just feels like this movie was literally written as the Jeff Gordon story with Tom Cruise playing Jeff Gordon, it's always been odd to me that came out 2 years before. So it was kind of like an eerie foreshadowing, you know.
So something interesting that Brady probably knows is that Jeff Gordon's original number for the Cup Series was actually going to be the 46 number. Did you know that?
I did know that, yeah. It was supposed to be 46, and they'd actually run that number a few times with Al Unser Jr. and some other guys in kind of like a start and park situation as a development program. But I never really heard why they last-minute changed for 46. Did you ever get that story?
A lot of speculation, because there hasn't been there's been some people saying this is the reason, but the biggest speculation is that there were still some movie rights issues, and that the movie studio somehow owned that number for it, which for how much money was put into everything, I could see that being the actual case, but it's really hard to tell. But that's one that that a lot of people have said, hey, this is what I've heard, and it's coming from multiple sources, like, okay, that sounds, you know, it's not like one guy, like, this is the reason why. No, it's multiple sources have said, you know, it was an issue with the movie studio having some sort of rights to the number for some reason, even though it's a NASCAR. But you're right, that movie, and we talked about this last week on how there was specialty cars made that ran in the Daytona 500, didn't make any money, they were used for action shots, it was a fantastic thing. Rick Hendrick fielded the cars with some drivers, but they also had, we talked about this last week as well, is that Dale Earnhardt Sr. was offered the role to be the bad guy in that movie.
Yeah, and
I should say.
Well, yeah, and it was just the amount of, you could tell that they had done their research and they wanted to do right by the sport. And while it's not a perfect movie by any means, the heart is there, and they really did a good job of encapsulating a particular time and space in the sport. And for that, it's also a good reference just for, you know, the long days of yesteryear when, you know, independent teams could actually make it in the top level of the Cup League and actually grow into a championship caliber team because there wasn't such the disparity that there is nowadays. But one thing that that movie, and honestly, I got to go back to Stroker Ace and give it some props. Both, because that came out in 82, Stroker Ace and Days of Thunder in 1990, and both had phenomenal racing footage scenes. I know for Days of Thunder, they were actually able to get cars on the track to, you know, during actual races to get some good shots. I don't know if they had that same capability with Stroker, but for being the time period that they were and the technology that they had access to, they still made all of those racing sequences in both movies really lifelike and really realistic. And they did a very good job of blending, you know, stage shots and stage footage that they had recorded themselves and also clips from race broadcasts that was interlaced in between to kind of give it, you know, that realistic feel, that broadcast feel. And so that was something that I think both of those movies did extremely well. And I think that, you know, that they kind of almost had a leg up on a couple of some of the more modern movies. Like, I think the action sequences in both those movies are way better than Talladega Nights, way better than some of the other movies I've seen that have kind of had stage racing footage, definitely better than Herbie Fully Loaded. I'll tell you that much. But,
tell me that wasn't realistic.
That is something that definitely took me by surprise when I watched Stroker Ace this week, and I didn't know what to expect from the action sequences or the race footage, and they looked pretty darn good. So I do have to give the movie props in that regard.
So the other big thing, because I glossed over it, because it's a little more easier for drivers to do this, is the TV. NASCAR drivers, my chair just broke, I think. NASCAR drivers have been in TV shows, and then the earliest one being Cale Yarborough and Dukes of Hazzard. But even since then, there's been multiple appearances, not many in the 80s in all reality, not many in the 90s, but a lot in the 2000s, even some getting video game spots. One big one that I can recall is, which one was it? It was, I'm drawing a blank. Man, it was Mark Martin. He was in Baywatch.
Mark Martin was in Baywatch?
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yep. He was in Baywatch in 1999. He was a street racer that had an exchange with one of them. I had to look this up. I wrote a lot of this stuff down, luckily. But that was one that a lot of people, I mean, if you know what Baywatch is, of course you know. Everyone watches it for the slow motion.
Nobody knows what Baywatch is. Come on.
Well, they know what it is. They just don't know the plot. I didn't watch it for the plot.
Well, there is one. There was no plot. That's your problem, Zach. Go ahead.
But that was one that kind of kicked off, you know, drivers coming more into TV, because it was one of the things where they could come in a lot of times if it was a bit part. Like a majority of these that I have on here are bit parts. You know, another one that happened just in 2012 with the show called Last Man Standing with Tim Allen was Tony Stewart. Right after, I think that was the year he won the championship, right?
If it was after 2011, it would be right off a championship.
Okay, so it was 2012, so it was after he won that championship. That one was Last Man Standing is based off a man who lives in a house full of women, his wife and his daughters, and he owns a sporting goods store, and Tony Stewart was going to have them as a sponsor on a race, and Tony did a very cool thing. They even had one of Tony's cars in the show, which was a lot of fun.
And that was always just a good way to, you know, try and get NASCAR in the culture, you know, the pop culture subconscious, as it were. And one genre, you know, kind of similar to how they cameo in TV shows, big in the early 2000s, especially with, you know, and trying to embrace the young gun drivers, the new crowd, the drivers that were trying to appeal to the younger 18 to 35-year-old, that key demographic. You were seeing drivers also do cameo bit parts in music videos. I arguably the most iconic one that comes to mind would be Dale Jr. and Tony Stewart showing up in a Three Doors Down music video. But being heavily involved with not only rock stars and rock artists was also another way that NASCAR could use their drivers and kind of cameo appearances, but also try and, you know, reach that younger demographic. That's always a key goal for any corporation. And they did this quite well, you know, like I said, by putting drivers in music videos. They had that great partnership between Chevy, their drivers, and the Richmond race went with the Chevy Rock and Roll 400. So Chevy drivers would partner up with famous rock bands of the time, and they would put those rock bands on their cars. Like Three Doors Down was on one, Nickelback was on one, the Bare Naked Ladies, Gretchen Wilson, Big and Rich, all were bands that would partner with NASCAR to try and also utilize music and just how influential music in pop culture is to try and get NASCAR and NASCAR drivers further into the public consciousness.
I did not realize that Bare Naked Ladies was on a NASCAR. I'll have to look that one up, see if maybe they have a
diecast. Actually, it's a very famous one, too. It was Kevin Harvick's 2006 Richmond winning car, and that is one of my favorite paint schemes that he ever ran because it was black and a very, very dark charcoal gray for the fin design he had on his Goodwrench car back then and some yellowish-orange highlights. The band was on the hood. Just a beautiful, beautiful car, and Harvick took it to victory lane with a last pass to boot in that race. So that was a really exciting one. I remember watching that one in my uncle's garage. That's how memorable it was.
Yeah.
I can remember exactly where I was watching that one.
And they did make a diecast. Well, one thing that's interesting, too, is just the amount of the variety of shows as well, because music is a big one in music videos and these sponsorship, but it's also the variety of shows. Of course, I mentioned a couple more comedy types. I would imagine that's what Baywatch is. I don't know. I didn't pay attention too much to the plot. But it's the variety. Like, we had I believe it was Days of Our Lives? Yeah, or General Hospital, I'm sorry. Jeff Burton made an appearance on General Hospital in 2009.
Dang.
And even and as well,
I
mean, there. Like I said, I've made a list. I can go down a list of about 15 that are on here. One of the newest ones, not too sure if it's still going to come out or not, is called SEAL Team. Austin Dillon had a cameo appearance in a recent episode. Brad Keselowski and Joey Logano were in Sharknado 3. Carl Edwards was in 24 back in 2006.
Carl Edwards would be a perfect driver to cameo on 24. I mean, God, that's just a match made in TV heaven. And honestly, going back to the bit part on Baywatch, they couldn't have picked a better driver than Mark Martin to be in the swimsuit show, because that, for being 60, Mark Martin is jacked. Good God. That boggles my mind, just his fitness regime and just how dedicated he is. I'm like, that is aging goals, because he shows me that with a little can-do attitude and the right diet, you can do it. So I was like, damn it, I got to live the Mark Martin lifestyle.
That's for sure. Another one, Dale Earnhardt Jr. actually did a voice bit in the video game Scarface: The World Is Yours. That was an interesting one, because we don't really see video games besides the actual NASCAR games. Just, this one was an interesting one. It was for Xbox and I believe PlayStation back then. Jamie McMurray made his first ever TV appearance in 2005 on The West Wing, which was an interesting one. And then just 2 years later, Jamie McMurray again was in Passions, which that was a show I had to relook up, which was a soap opera based on the paranormal. John, I believe you have some homework now.
I don't remember it. I mean, it must have not happened in my lifetime. I must have been in a different time stream. Passion? All right, I'll check it out.
Another one was one I already said was General Hospital. Jeff Burton also made an appearance 4 years earlier on One Tree Hill. Funny enough, somehow.
Burton on One Tree Hill?
That's weird.
Yes, 2005.
I mean, all of One Tree Hill was weird.
It was your stereotypical, coming of age teenage drama, which I ate it up because I was the right demographic for it. But I had no idea that Jeff Burton was a guest star on one of those episodes. I'll have to find that. That is some homework for me.
Who has the most famous quote of all from One Tree Hill, and they sign their email with it?
I've got nothing. I never watched One Tree Hill.
Me?
I wouldn't.
Haven't you ever seen the bottom of my emails? It always says, I don't want to be anything other than what I've been trying to be lately. I think that's the greatest, most confusing statement in history. That's the famous quote from the song. And it's at the bottom of my emails. People say, did you ever watch One Tree Hill? I said, no. But I just think the quote's so weird. So, yeah. Me. That's how I found my emails.
To round out the rest of these I did research on, Jimmy Johnson was in a show called Las Vegas in 2006, the year he won his first championship. That one was a Sin City-based drama. This one is a funny one because of what the show is. Kyle Busch in 2013 was on a show of Charlie Sheen. Anyone want to take a guess on what it was called?
He made it onto Anger Management.
Yeah.
Or Two and a Half Men.
Nope, Anger Management.
Oh, okay.
Dude, I gotta watch that episode. That'd be hilarious.
That is definitely one that kind of suits Kyle sometimes if you see him the right time. A movie. No, this one is a TV show. I'm sorry. Matt DiBenedetto, our own Matty D, was on the TV show Lethal Weapon in
2018. Oh yeah.
About
that.
There was the Baywatch, like I said. Also, Mark Martin was in a show called Guiding Light in 2005. And the last one I had was the Tony Stewart Last Man Standing. Quite a bit of TV history, quite a bit of racing history, movie history, and commercial history. This was fun, and I feel like we are going to have some new segments. Me and Brady talked yesterday about some stuff, and I feel like we have some new stuff that will be coming. If we don't have racing coming back up, we have a couple of ideas. I'm writing some more down. We will talk about those. But it is time because we need to talk about the race of the week, our retro rewind, the Food City 500 from 2007.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Okay, before you get started, I've got the question of all time.
Uh-oh.
Who's that?
I know. Whenever I introduce something like that, Zach says, oh, no, what's he going to do? What's he going to say? I'm going to be, of course, the most inappropriate person in the world. So have you heard about the show that Kyle Larson's going to be on?
Uh-oh.
He's not.
Oh.
By the way, we had Zach on last week on Pop Culture Stars, so do we have any more news about Kyle Larson? Is he still just the most unpopular person in the
world? Well, no. Well, yes and no. A lot has it's kind of more simmered down right now. With no racing action, a lot of people aren't really, I don't want to say paying attention to it, but there's still some simmer about it. Kyle's still out of a ride, and we don't know what his next plan will be.
Oh, actually, I do have more than that. So he has been confirmed that he is right now trying to fast-track his NASCAR sensitivities training so he can at least be reinstated by the sport. So he is right now working with the sport, working with the officials on what he needs to do to get reinstated as a driver again, and then he can go from there. So he's also talked to many people in the industry and is just kind of trying to keep a low profile, trying to do some damage control, trying to really do some inner self-introspection. But last I heard, he is working with the sport about what he needs to do to at least get himself reinstated so we can start picking up the pieces and rebuilding his career and his reputation and honestly just his credibility as a person and someone who can be counted upon to be in such a prominent position in our society.
But he is certainly sought after as a driver. I mean,
obviously.
I wish him the best. I mean, everybody's made a mistake. Hang up if you've never made a mistake. We're still here, you know.
And what I meant by mine was, you know, there's no confirmation of him having, you know, rides set up or anything. You know, we know he's trying to fast track that sensitivity training, because that is something that a few drivers have had to do before. You know, I still wish him the best of luck. I'm still going to be a fan. He made a mistake. I've seen people sell off all their Kyle. I'm not a fan of Kyle. I'm selling all his stuff. He could take it, blah, blah, blah. I'm still going to keep my diecast and stuff there. You know, Kyle is an interesting fella. He will learn from his mistakes, but if he does it again, you can't, you know, that's just going to beat a dead horse. I'm like, all right, you can have it.
All right. Dr. John will now relinquish control of the television set to you guys about the Food City 500. I just had to stick that in there. And Zach, thank you for being on the show last week. We appreciated it.
Oh, it was fun. But again, we are talking about the Retro Rewind for the week, which is the Food City 500 from 2007. The significance about this race, the reason we picked it was because it was the first race with the COT car. There were tests and there were practices with it, but there was never a full-fledged race until this one. This race had an interesting start to it. And when I say that, I don't mean the actual start of the race. I meant the pre-race, the stuff where, you know, the drivers or they have the broadcasters talk about stuff. And there's two big points that got put across right away. One, teams are looking out for the wing, the rear tire changers, and as well as the gas men are watching out to not clip the wing so they don't break it and or fall or cause damage to the vehicle. Another one was the front splitter with the spacer and the solid carbon fiber the solid piece of plastic, essentially what it was back then, didn't get damaged by an air hose getting caught on it or a driver falling onto it. Those were two big ones. And actually, some teams put tape around the winglets on the COT cars to have more visibility for the crew members to see them while they're doing the changes.
Yeah, nothing. Honestly, that had ever happened in the sport prior to this race in 07 could have prepared these teams for the challenge that was the COT. We've never had a wing like that. I mean, the Dodge Daytonas were a big wing, but they were super tall and not like that kind of edgy, really sharp, easy to get, you know, caught up on, get something hung up on, like these, like the wings that were introduced in 07. And you talked about right there, that splitter was just unlike anything that teams and tire changers have ever had to deal with on a NASCAR Cup car. And that weird, gawky, seventh-grader-looking brace face front end thankfully didn't last too long, but that was something that was a challenge, and you could definitely see it play out throughout how the teams were tackling the pit stops throughout the race, how they were trying to orchestrate it and, you know, do different choreography with their quote-unquote pit stop ballet. It was just – it was fascinating just how a change like that could completely force an innovation for the teams and drivers to try and, you know, work their way around that. And it was something that I didn't quite pick up on when I was a kid watching that for the first time, but going back and rewatching that race, it was definitely something that has stood out to me the few times I've went back and rewatched that.
And this is something too that, you know, there was a lot of unknowns to this, to what was happening. And the reason I say that is, and again, Brady has said it, they never did much with this. Teams had, quote-unquote, practice with it, but they never did actual live pit stops at a race. They never did it during practice. They really couldn't. It was one of those things where everyone was preparing for the best, but also had all the worst-case scenarios ready because they knew they would probably need them. And something that's interesting about this is that every team had to have them, and we still had 50 cars enter the weekend. One got withdrawal before the weekend officially started. Chad Chinflin for Bob Jenkins, a.k.a. Front Row Motorsports, was withdrawn, but there were still seven or six cars that did not qualify with this new aero package or with the new car.
And this was also right during the first season for Toyota. And if you look down the fail to qualify list, this was right in the growing pain for Mike Waltrip Racing, as the only driver from their stable that made it was Dale Jarrett. Surprisingly, this was the first time that Red Bull Racing, one of the brand new teams with that Toyota banner, this was the first time that their two teams had both qualified for a race. So it was kind of interesting, not only watching the race, but also picking up on the storylines, remembering, you know, just the very humble beginnings of now the powerhouse that is Toyota Racing, and just how much they struggled that first season trying to get the Gen 4 car ready for the half season, but also look towards the future and really put a lot of emphasis and effort into the COT, knowing that that was going to be the full-time car going forward. And honestly, I saw that trend kind of play out as the 07 season wore on. When it seemed like when they got to the normal races, when they were using the old car, the Toyota teams were definitely struggling, definitely were not there, did not have the power to the aero balance that they were needing. But when they got to these COT races, there was definitely an uptick in their performance, because you could see that was where the effort was laid in that first season. Was they knew that was the car of the future, and that was where they had to put a lot of their engineering. And it showed, because their teams were a lot more successful, I felt like, in those races. But also, kind of one thing kind of throwing it into the they weren't prepared for it basket, there was something, I don't know, I can't remember if it planned out in this race, but I know it definitely showed up at the Martinsville race, the very next one that they ran this COT car, was they were also not prepared for that foam that they were putting in the door. If you're new to the sport and you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, it was brand new with the 07 COT car that they would put this this kind of flame-resistant, you know, impact foam, similar to what they use in the construction of the safer barriers, in the door between the door skin and the roll bar to kind of create an extra padding to help lessen the impact of drivers whenever they hit the wall. And those first couple races, there were some incidents where the foam in the door was actually catching fire and smoke was coming from the door of the car. I know Kevin Harvick ran into it at Martinsville, and I want to say Tony Stewart ran into an issue with it as well. And not just with the COT itself, teams were also experimenting with different engine packages, and Chevrolet was in the process of unveiling the Chevy's Z01 package for racing to coincide with them bringing in the Impala and the Impala SS nameplate with the COT. And they were also struggling with fuel lines and some different things about getting the kinks worked out with that car. And those are some storylines that I know were talked about a lot in those first few races of the COT as part of those growing pains, and something that I kind of forgotten about. But until we rewatched these, I was like, man, that was something that was kind of a hot button topic there for those first few races. And it didn't take them long to figure both of those issues out, but it was always kind of interesting to know that was a part of the growing pain, that they weren't prepared for some of those new additions safety-wise.
That is for sure. And, you know, I had mentioned that they did some testing with the cars, but they never did anything excessive. You know, they never had a great example during and they talked about this during the race. Tony Stewart did 110 laps on the last practice session before the race. 110, we don't often see drivers do that many laps. During practice, we might see 40, maybe 50. And yes, I know it does vary speedway, racetrack to racetrack, speedway to speedway. But still, doing 110 laps, that just showed that they weren't too sure how these cars were going to react. They still weren't sure how fast or how slow or how this or how that the cars were going to be. And Tony Stewart did have one of those early issues. He didn't have the fire, but he had it where one of the fuel lines was coming undone, and they had to fix that. And that's something, again, that it's growing pains, and luckily it did happen early on, and it wasn't something like he was going for a championship run, you know, at a Homestead. Instead, it was something six races in where he can recover those, you know, I mean, golly, he led 257 laps and he finished 35th. And there was only a few DNFs, you know, from crashes, and some people did go back out. But it is one of those things where, you know, those growing pains, this is where they started. We saw the very first one really was that. And also, I believe it was Ryan Newman. Yes, it was Ryan Newman who crashed, and he was one of the first drivers to have an incident where the radiator essentially got destroyed because of where it was mounted.
Oh, yeah. No, there was definitely some things that they were not prepared for because the testing just didn't bring that up. But one thing that also really stood out to me about this car was just the teams in particular and the manufacturers that really latched onto it in the beginning. If you look down our top 10, You see there's 8 Chevrolets and only 2 Fords, and you have to go down to 13th to see the high-finishing Dodge, David Stremme, and have to go down to 15th for Brian Bickerson, the highest-finishing Toyota. In 07, especially in 07, the two names you heard a lot were Chevrolet and Hendrick Motorsports, and looking down this top 10, you don't have to really imagine why. 3 of the Hendrick Motorsports drivers got their cars in the top 10. 2 of them in the top 3, with Kyle Busch winning the race, Jeff Gordon in 3rd. We also have the teams of Richard Childress Racing, which got Jeff Burton and Kevin Harvick, both top 5. Dale Earnhardt Jr. snuck in there with his Budweiser Chevrolet in 7th. Clint Bowyer, also for Richard Childress Racing, netted the top 10, so all 3 of the Richard Childress Chevrolets were there. And that was just something that you saw pan out the first half of the season. Anytime they ran these COT cars, it was won by a Chevrolet. And all but one in the first half of the season, up until we got to New Hampshire, was won by a Hendrick Motorsports driver. Because that team, they latched on and figured that car out faster than anyone. And it showed. They were constantly picking up, you know, wins, which was also really, you know, fascinating for me to go back and rewatch these races. Because, you know, growing up with the statistics, I'm like, man, no one had anything for Hendrick Motorsports. They just flat out dominated the COT races. But watching the race, that wasn't the case, and that was something that really stood out to me. You mentioned it right there. The dominator of this race was Tony Stewart. He led almost half the race. Him and Denny Hamlin both had strong Chevrolets and led the bulk of the laps. And the same storyline panned out the next weekend at Martinsville. The Joe Gibbs Racing drivers were the strongest on those first couple COT races. But they just could never capitalize and put together the full package, and it took them until Denny Hamlin won at New Hampshire that July for them to win their first COT race. And that was something that was lost on me, because I was just looking back, you know, on the statistics and the history books, like, man, Hendrick Motorsports, they had them all covered. But Hendrick really just capitalized, you know, late in the going when Joe Gibbs Racing faltered, and just were in the right position at the right time and made the right adjustments to put their names in the history books. And that was something that was really fascinating, and I enjoyed a lot rewatching this race.
That is something, too, was that just, by the way, for StatBucks, that was Hendrick's 200th win, and that was also Chevy's 600th win in the NASCAR.
Actually, Hendrick wouldn't get their 200th win until Darlington 2012.
I wonder if that's overall then, because they had said at the in the end interview, it was great to get Hendrick his 200th win. Maybe that was overall, including Xfinity back then, Busch Series stuff.
That makes sense, because, yeah, I know they didn't get their 200th Cup win until Jimmy Johnson did it at Darlington in 2012.
All right, I thought it was going crazy there for a second. But there's that's a big step, but you're right. You know, they were dominant, but it's not – and one thing, too, it's not like – Hendrick was the back of the pack for the most of it. Kyle Busch, Jeff Gordon was started first. I thought he started second for some. No, he did start first. Kyle Busch started 20th, but he moved up really quick. And along with Casey Mears started 16th, but was up there pretty fast as well. So they were up there. It's not like they caught some lucky strategy, but instead were quick, but it was Joe Gibbs Racing who caught on really quick. All three of their cars, I believe J.J. Yaley even led he led 9 laps. So all of Joe Gibbs, they led the most as an organization. They didn't get the win. All the cars finished outside the top 10. Denny Hamlin finishing 14th, which is still really decent. He just had a bad, I think it was a bad a tire or something that caused him, or a bad pit call that just caused him to fall that way. That's just how it is sometimes. So I look at these, and, you know, you said Dodge was up there. There's one Dodge up there. Mike Bliss was up, you know, finished 17th, but that 49 car and the 40 of where's the 40 car? I just saw it. Where'd it go? I'm going crazy. David Stremme, even he was up there, which was, you know, fascinating to see both of them up there running really hard in this, and that just showed that this was kind of an equalizer for them, because they weren't having the best season to start off.
Oh, yeah, no, that was the biggest success of the Car of Tomorrow. It was the most equal the playing field I feel like has ever been in the sport, and it showed in the on-track product. Given, you know, the car looked hideous. I mean, that's just the elephant in the room. We're just going to get that out of the way.
Be honest.
But the racing was just absolutely phenomenal. I will always maintain that while it was not a good-looking car, the Car of Tomorrow was a great race car. Like, it, you could take that to any of the tracks and get it to run okay, run decent. And they were usually pretty bunched up close, especially on the short track. The short track races with the old COT were some of the last, really, in my opinion, really good short track races where they could really stay on top of each other, really beat and bang. And this Bristol race really just stood out in my mind. There was a lot of, you know, incidents. There was a lot of close racing. The drivers were staying close. The bump and run was used a lot that afternoon, just a lot of bumping and running because the cars were so durable. They could take a lot. You know, they could take that old licking and keep on ticking, as the saying goes. And that to me will always be the legacy for the box on wheels, was that it was an atrocious, god-awful thing to look at, but, man, it was fun to watch a race.
It definitely had a lot of great, and I do mean it's great racing action at all levels of tracks because, and I said this last, I didn't even say this last week. I said this to Brady last night when we talked for a while. It didn't matter what the cars were. They were the same. So, for instance, the year prior, 2006, they didn't have these test cars at the tracks racing. You had two styles. You had a super speedway car, which had a very big front bumper, very tall, very looking, still had a slight slant to it. And then you had all the other cars were very slant nose. The difference in height between the two bumpers, give or take, you know, some variations, was almost 3 inches plus. But here, across the board, it's the same car. Super speedway, short track, and fun fact, and I believe I told Brady this last night, they had teams at the Daytona 500 for 2008 bringing those some of those cars that they ran at, like Martinsville or Bristol, to the track because you could run a super speedway and run a short track the next weekend with it.
And no, that was was something that was really great about the car because it brought NASCAR back to a time and place when I didn't think that they'd ever see it. It was the closest that it felt to being like back in the 1980s. And Darrell Waltrip talked a lot about that in the early broadcast with those COTs. That the versatility of the car, the fact that you could take one car and really take it from track to track, it was something that wasn't seen in the sport since the heyday of the 80s when, you know, the cars were still kind of somewhat stock, still based off their stock counterparts, and there was a lot more, you know, a lot smaller budgets, so you had to get a lot more out of the cars back then. And the COT was the first thing that really in the sport in a long time that made it feel like those good old days where, you know, you didn't need a whole fleet of cars. You could get through a season with maybe one or two in your stable. It wouldn't be pretty, but you could do it. And that was something, from a cost perspective, was hugely critical for the sport, especially during 07, 08, 09, the peak of the economic crash that really crippled the sponsorships that the teams were relying on, really crippled television ratings, ticket sales. It was a necessary evil that really came at a proper time when the sport needed a car like that.
And so I want to bring this to point real quick, and this isn't with this car, but like you said, that using these cars at multiple events, no matter what, one driver in the truck series, Jordan Anderson, did that for a season. He had one truck that he ran in every single race, and it got him through all of them, including getting him a very solid finish at Michigan that year. I want to say it was 2013?
That sounds about right.
Sounds about right. Yeah, it sounded close enough to me. But this race has also had just some names like Burton's, not Jeb, not Harrison, but Jeff and Ward Burton ran in it. I was just like, you know, that's kind of cool to see. And even, I believe Ward Burton, the four car, he had the state water heaters, which his son Jeb actually has sponsorship with him and runs a lot of races with, which was really cool. But look at some of the numbers and some of the team numbers. Tony Raines, who's a crew chief now, correct?
No, I think spotting duties.
That's right.
And driver coaching.
He was running. Yeah, that's right. He ran the 96 car, which had a few different drivers throughout that season. The 01 car with Regan Smith, he was sharing that with Mark Martin, who, going into the race, by the way, was the points leader. He said, hey, Regan, here, take the ride. Wait, what? but you had Red Bull running really well at points. AJ Allmendinger running, had some issues early on, though, that caused them to go many laps down. But you had even Robbie Gordon sponsored his own self. He couldn't get a sponsor. So he said, you know what, screw it. Robbie Gordon, off-road wheels, going to be the sponsor. He still finished, you know, only 7 laps down, which isn't crazy, but he finished 33rd, but he was up there for some of it, too. But I look at this list, like you said earlier, of the cars that did not qualify. Kevin LePage for Front Row Motorsports, David Ruderman with Domino's Pizza for Michael Waltrip Racing. Michael Waltrip himself did not qualify. Joe Niemicek. And fun fact about that race, that was the first race he did not qualify in a very long time, and they said that during the podcast. Johnny Sauter and Paul Menard, which that one was surprising to me considering DEI's success and how well they were doing. They had two cars, Dale Earnhardt and Regan Smith running, and they couldn't even get their third car in.
Actually, that was a storyline that planned out a lot for the 15 ride in those first couple of years, because Menard attempted a few races in 06 and was supposed to go full-time racing in 07, and they had a lot of trouble getting that car qualified in. And what eventually solved that was later on in that season, 07, Dale Earnhardt Incorporated merged with Bobby Ginn Racing. Bobby Ginn was the team owner of Joe Niemicek's car, that 13 that you were just mentioning, and the 01 of Regan Smith that you also mentioned. And they merged those two teams, and DEI took the owner's points from Bobby Ginn's number 14 that was driven by Sterling Marlin that was actually having a fairly decent season and was locked in the top 35 in owner's points, which secured them a spot. They gave the owner's points from the Sterling Marlin ride and basically consolidated that team into the number 15 Menards program to give Paul Menard guaranteed starting positions for the rest of the season, which eventually carried into 08. And was kind of the foundation for Paul Menard having a fairly modest career that would take off 08 going forward. You brought up something that was always fascinating for me every time we go through these old races, which is looking down the finishing order and looking at the team owner names. We were talking about right there, Dale Earnhardt Incorporated and Ginn Motorsports. Ginn Motorsports, many of you might actually know that as MB2, it was renamed Bobby Ginn from Motorsports, I believe in 06. And that was a team that was a very, you know, prominent mainstay in the early 2000s, especially with the iconic 01 Army car. This was their last season. As I said, they merged with DEI and would eventually fade out of the sport. Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, this was a couple weeks before the major announcement that Dale Earnhardt Jr. would not be returning to the iconic 8 car. By Bristol, they were still heavy rumors, but everything seemed like indications were that they were moving in good talks, that things were encouraging, and that they were going to get a new contract signed and keep him at the family-owned team, but it wouldn't be. But about 3 or 4 weeks, not even that, maybe like 5 or 6 weeks later at the Darlington race, Mother's Day weekend, that it was announced that Dale Earnhardt Jr. would be moving on, and that's what really began the implosion of that team to where it's no longer a fully functioning racing team. It's rather now just a glorified museum that is just such a waste of space. It was such a beautiful, beautiful mecca of speed, just an absolutely immaculate race shop that is now just your typical tourist destination stop on your way through Mooresville. And that's, to me, something I will never forgive. But, you know, I'm not bitter or petty or anything about that, right? But Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, they're no longer with us. This was back when Petty Enterprises was still the iconic level cross Petty team, the family-owned team, before they would eventually merge with Gillette Everhand Motorsports 2 years later. So they were already on their last leg. Same with the aforementioned Everhand Motorsports. They were coming off what was a great, you know, statement-making 06 season and then just completely falling off the map in 07. That would eventually start their slow dying process of decay to where they would eventually merge and cease to no longer be a racing team. Furniture Racing, they were just getting their humble beginnings. They were not nowhere near the championship team that they were that took them to the 2017 title. Very humble beginnings. Kenny Wallace piloting that car. And just the list goes on. And that's what's always so rewarding and, you know, honestly more entertaining than actually seeing who wins these old races is just seeing these storylines, seeing these teams, and just kind of reflecting, you know, with that 2020 vision that we all have now when we go back and watch these races of, man, if only they knew where the sport was going to take them in some in the next couple weeks, but a lot over the next couple of years, you know. And that's something that I always get a lot of enjoyment out of, watching these old races.
And it also is cool to see a lot of – there's still a lot of drivers from 07 out of racing, Kyle Busch, Kevin Harvick, Clint Bowyer. You know, it's still cool to see a lot of these drivers still racing, but it is weird to see a lot of them not at the same time. I mean, one of them that's obvious is Mike Bliss, the American, if you watch the first season of not Top Gear, but whatever the Amazon show is called.
You're thinking Mike Skinner.
Mike Skinner. Right, good point. Never mind. Mike Bliss, not Mike Skinner. But going through it, there's even Kyle Petty, who didn't have, you know, a star-studded career. People always said the same thing: "Oh, you're going off your dad's coattails and this." And he even addressed that at one point. He's like, "Yes, I did, but guess what? I still ran," and that's a valid point. He ran for some great teams, including his father's team. But I love, you know, looking down this and seeing Scott Riggs, Juan Pablo Montoya, Robbie Gordon, Jeremy Mayfield. Yeah, and even seeing the beginnings of Martin Truex Jr., you know, getting one of his first real seasons underneath his belt, having an issue early on and crashing out. But still, it's great to see a lot of these. Even Reed Sorensen, who still races here and there for smaller teams, but still does great, including having some stellar qualifying runs at the super speedways, like at Talladega just a couple years ago.
Exactly. Now, it was a fun watch, and honestly, I could go back and watch any of these 07 COT races. The Darlington race that year was fantastic. The Martinsville races were both pretty darn good. My favorite, though, is the early 07 COT races will always be the fall Richmond race, just because I always loved Richmond as a track. It reminds me so much of Iowa Speedway. But the 07 fall race, when Dale Jr. ran one of my favorite all-time paint schemes, when he ran this beautiful all-white Budweiser car that had Elvis Presley's face on the hood. Had beautiful, made it look like a guitar case. The number 8 did have this studded pattern around it. And that was something that I got to say was also a really big thumbs up, at least for me, whenever I think back about the COT era of NASCAR, is that car lended itself so well to some of the best looking paint schemes the 2000s had to offer. Like, I can just think of so many schemes that were just so good, so clean, just really worked well with, you know, the flatter surface of the car, really just popped. And that was something I really enjoyed about the COT era. Some of my very favorite paint schemes of all time were during that era. And I also really, really enjoyed the Red Bull cars. I liked how they matched. Mm-hmm. I liked how they had they didn't have it at the Bristol race, but a couple weeks later they would do the red wheels in the back be painted red so it could accentuate the Red Bull on the back of the car. And I really enjoyed that. So that was something also I got to give props to with the winged beast, is it made for a pretty good canvas for a sponsored paint scheme.
So that is one. Well, first off, I really did enjoy talking about this race because it is a fun race. It is an interesting one, and the reason we picked it started the era of these new cars. And we also had Kyle Busch being like, "I still can't stand these things," and then just a little while longer, Denny Hamlin would say something similar and get fined by NASCAR, which was hilarious. But one thing that we need to talk about real quick is our next race, which is going to be if you talk about NASCAR, there's a fan favorite race for a lot of people. And if you talk NASCAR to the generation like us and the generation before us, it's always going to be Dale Earnhardt Sr.'s win at the Daytona 500 in 1998.
Oh, yeah, no. There's nothing more iconic than that win, than that moment. Kind of a controversial opinion. I think that overall the race is not one of the more exciting races I've ever seen, and that I feel like it gets a lot of clout for being Dale Sr.'s one and only Daytona 500 win, and I'll talk a lot about that on next week's race. But, you know, that criticism aside, I mean, there is nothing more historic, more iconic than those last two laps, seeing that black Goodrich car finally get the checkered flag at our most hallowed ground. So that will forever be a classic race in everyone's memories, and you can't do a race rewind and not at least bring it up. So I'm excited to once again, you know, go back in time to 1998, a time and space when I was only 5 years old, and relive one of the most iconic moments our sport has ever drummed up.
That is for sure. So that race will be our retro rewind, and that's one I'm not going to watch at 2 speed, but in fact I will watch at regular speed instead of watching the races this week at 2 speed. But that was something that you said earlier about paint schemes. So yesterday, Brady called me because we needed to get some ideas since we're still unsure of when the whole NASCAR epidemic, when this whole thing is going to end and we're going to go back racing. So we started talking about other races, and we have a few jotted down for ourselves, and I'm going to kind of arrange them to be good. But one thing that we started talking about just randomly was NASCAR racing paint schemes. So what we're, and some other stuff too, but one thing that I think we're going to do, I'm going to push it back 1 week though. Instead of doing it next week, we're going to do it the week after so we can get some more, because I have an idea, and I'll have to have you, Brady, send me a lot of your favorite ones. But we're going to do some of our favorite paint schemes, whether it's from this year. Well, we're not going to do this year. This year we're going to wait until the end of the year to do our favorite paint schemes. But what we're going to do is our favorite paint schemes overall, whether it's just from last year, 10 years, 15, 20 years, 40 years, even at the humble beginnings of NASCAR, we're going to talk about some of our favorite paint schemes, the drivers that are associated with them, and also some of the controversial between some of them as well. But for the next week, what we're going to talk about instead is, so we've had some of the iRacing. I know we haven't talked about it a couple of weeks because it's kind of been the same. But we have an interesting track this week. It's Talladega. And you can't go without watching that race, even on iRacing, because let's just say cars at 200 miles per hour on a video game, what kind of craziness could happen, and who's going to win that race? So I feel like that's one race we will have to talk about next week, is the iRacing event this week for Talladega.
Oh, yeah, definitely we're going to have to mention that. We're kind of running short on time. I wanted to bring it up a little bit, so we'll have to talk more about it in depth next week. But we'd be remiss to at least bring up the fact that there are rumblings going on that NASCAR is working with not only teams and officials, but also with government officials and different politicians about what some maybe steps could be about possibly getting the sport back on track, at least from a competition standpoint, not opening up the stands, you know, to any fans, but trying to at least see if we can get key personnel to the track. Personally, I'm very apprehensive and skeptical about the whole ordeal, just because I feel like we're not taking the seriousness of the COVID outbreak as serious as we need to be, but I'm also kind of taking a wait and see approach with it, as probably the rest of the world is, just kind of seeing, you know, letting them present to me what steps they're taking to accomplish this. But to kind of touch on it a little bit tonight, basically in surmising, is there's rumors and talks going on that NASCAR is looking to at possibly hosting races without fans, severely limiting the amount of teams and personnel at the track to try and keep social distancing relevant and keeping teams spaced out enough to not put any of their employees in harm's way. But as a way to try and get the season back up and running, and maybe looking at some of the tracks in the southern part of the state, tracks like Darlington, Charlotte, and that are kind of close to teams' head bases that would be easy to get to. And there's a lot of talk that Eddie Gossage, who is the president of Charlotte Motor Speedway, is in talk with the Republican lawmakers in Carolina and also the governor about maybe moving forward with the first race being the Coca-Cola 600 running the iconic Memorial Day weekend. I know that's a very important weekend for the sport, especially for the Charlotte area, and I know how much that would hurt the overall economy of the Charlotte area. So I know that that is a very, very important thing that they're looking at. So I did want to at least bring it up that we're going to be keeping an eye on it and monitoring the situation as the month progresses and as we get more details.
All right, Brady, that's great. Zach, you're going to have a good week as much as you can.
I think I'm going to drink my sorrows away.
Okay. Brady, you're going to have a good week until we see each other next Tuesday?
I mean, I have no plans to not have a good week, so I'm on board with that.
All right, I'm going to have a great week. We'll see you guys next week in exactly 7 days at the Charlotte Line, 7 days minus 1 hour and a half. Take care.
Oh, yeah, it is 7 days.
Bye, guys.
Bye.